Any other questions for Ms. Gill while she's up here?
I had a question. You packed a lot of information, and it I can tell from looking at our budget, and this is more informational almost, but of course, we're here, and we're looking like, how can we help? Mm-hmm. And so when you started talking about the Family First, what was the full act, name of the act?
Families First Prevention Act.
You used a phrase that I was trying to understand it, saturation of geographical.
So when we talk to mental health providers about doing business in Goochland County, a lot of their offices are based in either Richmond or Charlottesville. So they don't necessarily have a staff people out here that can come out and actually provide the service. And then we ask them, okay, well, would you open an office out here to provide the service so that you could be closer to our citizens? And they say, well, how many clients can you get me? And if we can't tell them that we have that much of a saturation of business, then it's not really worth their time financially to actually do that. And so that's when we talk about that rate.
So you said we need the act to get the funding requires some evidence-based.
It will fund certain evidence-based practices, and that is a federal definition of what those practices are. And they're about, Stacey, how many are about half a dozen services that they're looking at?
Well, it sounded like you needed to provide X number of services to get access to these funds.
No, it's just if those particular services should be available through those funds. So if we have a provider who provides those services, our children can get those services under that funding source. So it's just a matter of who's going to provide that service and where they're located.
So people, though, right now in need of services, while it may be not geographically convenient, you're not facing a situation where people can't get the services because of
certain services aren't provided in our area. So there are services where there are actually no provider that's going to, some of the services are provided in the home, and some of the services are provided in a therapy office. So the ones that are provided in a therapy office, people could go to Richmond or go to Charlottesville to access those services. The services that are required to be done in the home, we don't have necessarily the providers to provide those services in the home due to those geographic restrictions. Does that help explain?
It does make sense. Again, I'm looking at this with an eye like, what can we do to help? What needs are being unaddressed? If it's just we're trying to put something together to get some funds, then mm-hmm. the question would be, well, how much are the funds and is it worth the effort?
Right.
But if it's services not going needed, and right. then that's maybe, you know, kind of.
Well, part of it is we're looking at there's issues with certification of the service by the providers. Sometimes it's cost prohibitive for certain providers to provide the service. Some providers are required to have so many clients and so many clinicians, and it's not financially feasible for them to do that as well. There's a myriad of reasons having to do with each one of those services and how they're licensed with the particular providers.
Good. Well, you packed a lot of information. And of course, you know, anytime that, you know, if you come to us with a need or, you know, I hope you don't hesitate
Absolutely.
To articulate and express the need if we can. But I know you do an awful lot of work, and thank you for all you're doing.
Is that
all we're going to hear on the library? Because I know Mr. Shepley.
We have Mr. Shepley here if you have questions for him,
you know,
as well.
I always love hearing about the regional library, and I'm not kidding. You always give a good presentation. I know there'll be another time of the year when you'll come talk to us. But if I do have a question on, we're dealing with broadband, and I know you all support that. So if you could just, you came all the way here. I'd love to give you an opportunity to just give us a brief update. I know we're here on a quick budget, but I know you all provide internet, or you help folks with internet, and that's something we're going to be dealing with throughout the rest of the years. We're looking to expand broadband. So you just have any updates on your front budget-wise or otherwise?
Yes, I guess just as everyone's world is different with the pandemic, we have returned to service. We're open 44 hours a week, down from our normal 60, in part because of vacancies and pandemic kinds of, you know, questions and concerns. Some of the changes that we have made have included offering hotspots that people can borrow, and I believe we're up to about 125 of those units. They're spread across the system, kind of where they're being used the most. But we were able to do that, and trying to make sure that we have just more resources available, particularly with the broadband. It is still available in our parking lot as well as it has been for quite some time.
And some of those Wi-Fi devices are out in Goochland.
Yes, Yeah, and through the pandemic, when we started rolling those out right before everything closed down, and I think that was a great thing because so many other agencies have also purchased them since, but we had some, and we were able to share them with both with the schools and governments across the region, just to help keep business going in the governments, as well as lending them to the public. That's been one of the big changes that we've had with the pandemic. So
I know on the school, we asked the schools, I had a question, like, if you can pull out the crystal ball, and when do you think kids will be back in the school? I guess, has your board and you looked at when you may be opening, going back to regular hours? Has that started to be discussed?
We have been looking at that. We lost about 40 people last summer. We generally have about 130 people, but we had about 40 that quit when we reopened last summer. We were closed. We wanted to reopen. We reopened with all kinds of protocols in place, masks, sanitizing, and everything. But at the time, 40% of our staff was over the age of 65, and a lot of people decided not to return. So we've been rehiring. We still have about 7 vacancies that are posted right now, and so staffing is still a bit of a concern. And I know that staff are generally very interested in being vaccinated, and I think we're probably going to wait to see what happens. I know in some localities, and of course the vaccination stuff is a big issue everywhere, but I know that I have colleagues in libraries in Virginia where the library is closed, but their staff have gotten vaccinations, and we've been open for a long time, and I've got like 2 people that have gotten vaccinations. So I think we'd like to see that happen a little more in the community, which it seems to be going better. And we'll look at that, because as the measure showed, not being open has been huge. We have kind of gotten back to where we were last year on circulation. So we're back on our track with the upward trend that we've had, and that's wonderful, but that's kind of been a long road with everything else that's been going on. So
any questions there? Thank you. I appreciate the update there.
Thank you.
And good luck with everything and hiring. It's good that I'm glad that you came here and said there are jobs in Goochland, right?
They've been all over. Every branch has had vacancies. Yeah.
Good. Okay. That's good to know.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I just had a quick one for Ms. Jefferson. I had a quick one for you, if you don't mind. In fact, I don't know if you can move to slide 20, I guess it was. Is that possible? Technology is great when it works. I think it was slide 20. Mm-hmm. There we are. The red line, I call it the hockey stick. It goes flat and then goes straight up. We had, this is a general question, so it's not meant to be too specific, but we had a lot of conversation 2 or 3 years ago when there was contemplation about passing the Medicaid expansion and what the potential impact might be on your office, in particular, both from a staffing, hours, caseload, and also expense, dollar amount, budget, that kind of thing. And we were doing some projections at that time to try and figure out and guesstimate where things might end up. We now are at least 2 years into the process now. How has those projections compared to the reality, if you will? Again, it's a very general question, but is this the level of caseload and expense that we were anticipating, or is it more than we anticipated or less?
It's more than what we were anticipating, and some of it is because of the COVID and the cases increasing because of that. We didn't expect to be this high. Some of it's from expansion, so expanded Medicaid. I think when I came in December, we talked about the federal government has allowed us not to close cases unless there's a death or somebody specifically requests us to. The issue that we've been talking to with the state is when they decide that we need to start looking at those annual renewals for these cases, that they're going to have to work with agencies to help us to get these cases closed. I have probably about 1,000, if not more, cases that the workers are going to have to work on getting their renewal documents. And that means the client has to provide the information about their income and their resources. The delays in the mail aren't going to help with that, but the state has assured us that they will work with us in getting some of those cases cleared out. Another thing that just slipped my mind is, I did talk about the delays in the mail. Staffing-wise, we've been very creative, so when I have experienced workers that leave, we have worked with part-time staff at other agencies to help us keep up with our caseloads. So they have the experience. We don't have to pay them health insurance or fringe, and we're able to keep up and maintain.
Okay. So you've been creative on the staffing side to be able to handle this increased caseload. If today, you know, 2 years ago we were trying to project what this might look like, as we sit here today, if you were to draw a dashed line or a dotted line going forward from here, is this, you know, COVID bubble that's going to come back down, or is this something where you project with additional expansion of Medicaid benefits that this will...
I think it's going to bubble down once the economy opens back up and people start getting employed again with health insurance benefits. And I also think that once we're able to close some of these cases, because the clients aren't providing us with the paperwork, that it's going to level off some. So I would probably look at about between 2017 and 2019 as our average numbers, because that's what it's been for the last couple of years.
Okay, so you're anticipating this to subside. You figured out ways from a staffing to handle the workload, and you're thinking the workload will come back down, and the expense and the budget item will come back down as well.
We do.
Okay, good.
We
well,
do.
That's helpful. That's very helpful. So,
good answer. Truthful. Truthful answer, not just a good answer. Truthful
that's
answer.
That's what makes it a good answer.
Yeah. And, well, we did have one benefit worker leave last year. We've made an offer to another person, but, again, it's that training. For that person. So what we did is those part-time individuals that we had working for them, we asked them if they could contribute extra hours during the week until we have this person fully trained.
Good. I know we've talked off and on about if you see there's a clear and present danger of a brain drain or a loss, that you kind of get out in front of that and just do what you can to ramp up and train somebody on the job kind of thing. And
right.
So anything that we need to know about on that front, if you just make sure we're aware. I appreciate that. Good. Thank you. That's all I had.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Dr. Frank, I just thank you for coming out as well. You, Mr. Shepley. Dr. Frank, if you want to come up and just again in the vein of, like, if you have any update, or certainly when we hear these things, I know it's a lot of information, but to the extent that you have anything that you think we can help with, we would love to hear. I know you've been working a lot with county administrator, county leadership on the vaccines, but if you have anything, and particularly in the vein of how can
sure.
we help?
Yeah, thanks. I'm Tom Frank. I'm the health director for Chickahominy Health District, and we are all working overtime, and initially the COVID pandemic response was responding to all the increase in cases and the epidemic curve going up, and of course, that's still going on, but now most of our focus is on vaccinations, and you've heard about the vaccination clinics. We've had a few Goochland vaccination clinics, very specialized clinics, including those for healthcare workers, those for firefighters and paramedics, and school teachers and school staff, and the elderly. And so now, going forward, starting Thursday, we're setting up regular vaccination clinics in Goochland County. Thanks to Goochland County Administration and Fire Rescue and a lot of support from all over the place, we're able to set up a regular clinic on Thursdays going forward here. Every Thursday we'll have a regular clinic. It'll probably start with 250 doses, and then it'll quickly ramp up to 500 doses a week and possibly even more than that. And as those second dose clinics pop up, we'll be doubling those again, and so it's quickly going to ramp up here. The number of doses given to Virginia has just suddenly doubled in the last couple of weeks, and we just got word about Johnson & Johnson. The new Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been approved, and in fact we're getting our first allotment this week of Johnson & Johnson, so we'll be able to provide Johnson & Johnson doses here in the near future. And the benefit of Johnson & Johnson vaccine is the one-time dose. You don't need to come back for a follow-up appointment. So in that respect, it's going to be a nice option for everybody to have. So now we have three options available: the Moderna vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We provided quite a few vaccines already in Goochland County. Over 7,000 vaccines have been given, and approximately 20% of the population has received at least one dose of vaccine as of today.
That's statewide?
So that's in Goochland County.
Oh, in Goochland.
Yeah, and statewide it's more like 14 or 15%. So Goochland is actually ahead of the state.
Gotcha. When you mentioned the Johnson & Johnson, and I've been reading about it, and I didn't know it was getting here that soon,
mm-hmm.
What does the Department of Health and your office do in terms of if somebody walks in and says, which one should I take? I mean, how do you feel that question?
So we basically tell them you take the one that's available, and that they're all very efficacious. We do not give Pfizer out right now in my district because we don't have the ultra-cold storage. And so we haven't been able to store the Pfizer vaccine. So therefore, we'll redirect people who request the Pfizer vaccine. We'll redirect them to another place who can offer that. Some of the healthcare systems are offering Pfizer vaccines, so that's an option. But Moderna, we've been giving out Moderna, and now we're able to give Johnson & Johnson in addition to Moderna.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Peterson?
Yeah, just on those Goochland clinics, just to clarify, you mentioned about 250 doses each session, each week, I guess, so about 1,000 a month in addition to what is already going on. Just to be clear, those are where the individual gets called and the reach out is to the individual. The individuals don't, it's not first come, first serve. We can just show up. It's, you have to be invited in. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. These are by invitation only.
Okay.
You've heard a lot about the waiting list and the pre-registration websites.
Right.
So those are there in order for us to be very methodical about our prioritization and going down that list. So and a perfect way to explain that is, If you have somebody who's 45 years old and relatively healthy, and you have somebody who's 85 years old, who do you want to give that vaccine to? You want to give it to the 85-year-old. So you don't want a 45-year-old jumping in front of the line before an 85-year-old, because that 85-year-old has at least a four times the risk of dying from COVID-19. And so it just kind of explains the reason why we're prioritizing the list, the waiting list of people. And we got to be very careful about how we allocate the vaccine out, because we want to save lives.
Yeah, there are state and federal guidelines around prioritization.
Yes, sir. There are federal guidelines and federal recommendations, and then there are state mandates, state recommendations and state mandates as far as who we can provide that vaccine to.
Okay. So it doesn't go, you know, who called in or registered first. It goes, everybody calls in, registers, and then you've got a list that's generated in Goochland, and it's prioritized according to those priorities.
Yes,
and then
exactly.
You reach out and invite that person to come in.
Yep.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Sharp.
Did I hear correctly that they had determined that the Pfizer vaccine did not have to be kept at a minus 40 degree temperature or something, that normal?
So they have recently changed the recommendations on Pfizer vaccine just in the last couple of days. So you are correct. The Pfizer vaccine traditionally needs to be stored at ultra cold temperatures, which means negative 60 to negative 80 degrees Celsius, and requiring a very specialized ultra cold freezer, which most health districts do not have. But the FDA has recently relaxed those guidelines to allow you to store it at freezer temperatures for a certain amount of time. Still not a long amount of time, but a certain amount of time. So that does starts to open up the possibility of more people being able to handle Pfizer vaccine.
So we aren't being shortchanged on total number of vaccines available to us simply because we can't freeze it.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Yep, our total allotment does not change because of that.
Okay.
So we simply substitute Pfizer vaccine for Moderna, and now we'll have the option to get Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Are they going to have the capability of expunging people that signed up two and three, four times? Because I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I signed up four times, which is counterproductive, but I got the shot, and I keep getting calls saying, show up, and they're leaving me messages, mm-hmm. and I know one person that happened to call back, and they said, they gave them their name, and they said, oh, okay, I'll tell them. John yeah. Smith. How are you going to tell? It just seems like there should be a way to get rid of those so that we can get people in faster.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, people signing up more than once doesn't really affect us getting the vaccine out. It has no effect on our efficiency of getting the vaccine out. But yeah, there are people who've signed up 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times, thinking that that's going to help them get in quicker. But it doesn't really.
It doesn't work.
We know who they are, and we've got a good list. The state pre-registration site is trying to get rid of duplicate entries, so they're able to go through and get rid of those duplicates. So that system seems to be working pretty well.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
The longer we go, the more questions you're going to get. But thank you for everything you're doing. And I know my question is more on the supply and demand of the vaccine and the numbers that we have. So we have 250, and then we're going to jump to 500. If we, say, get another influx of vaccines, are we prepared to be able to get more shots in arms if more shots become available?
Yeah, we are with the help of the county and fire rescue. And okay. We are looking at alternate venues. We've got several sites that have been really studied and picked out, and we've got several alternate sites. We're looking at venues that would accommodate much larger vaccination clinics, up to 1,000 or more.
So we're ready for whatever they can give us.
So we're ready.
That's amazing. Thank you. Thank everybody sure. that's working
yep.
on this.
And I think it's just amazing that 20% of the population has already received at least one vaccine after just a few weeks. And now the vaccine supply increasing, I think it's going to go very rapidly, and we're predicting that we'll be through all of phase 1B by third week of April, roughly, and we will be through the entire population by the end of June is our prediction, and that's the entire population who chooses to get the vaccine. Obviously, not everybody's going to choose to get it, but we predict maybe 70% of the population will choose to get that vaccine. And we should be able to get through to them. That 70% of the population by the end of June is our goal.
Thank you, Dr. Frank.
Yep. Thank you all. We appreciate it.
And thank you, Mr. Jones. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gill, Ms. Jefferson, Mr. Shepley, all of you appreciate the additional input. I know our staff has a plan, and I come in here and kind of blow it up. But... Good presentations, very helpful information. Thank you all. So I don't know where we are, but I know Ms. Horlacher's up. And
I'll tell you where we are. we are. Yes. I will go over some of the nonprofits that operate in Goochland and in our area, and that supports some services for our citizens in our area. So the first one we'll discuss is Goochland Cares, and I think we're all very familiar with this organization, very good organization, provides health care and basic human services to our Goochland neighbors. And there is a big long list of some of their performance measures, and 45 homes restored to safety through the critical home repair program. I'll point that out. And 78 families served through domestic violence. In terms of their budget, the budget request this year was actually about $40,000 more than the previous year, and that was primarily a request to go into their home repair program. We are proposing to leave the budget flat from the previous year, which would be $198,000. The challenge and outlook for Goochland Cares, of course, are to expand the home repair program, dental program, transportation program, continue to respond to the COVID pandemic crisis, and to fund their increased costs of operations, like all of us are. And there is a representative here, and so at the end we'll be able to ask any questions you have regarding Gutchel Cares. And then just some of the other smaller contributions we make to some of our agencies that operate within and around Gutchel County. We received 8 applications, about $65,000 request, and our recommendation is to fund 6 of those at $59,000. And those 6 are Feed More, or Meals on Wheels as it's known, CASA, they operate here in our building and down at the courts, of course, the Reynolds Community College, both capital and operating support, Senior Connections, and Senior Navigator. Those are the 6 agencies within the Health and Human Services functional area that we support. And then there were 2 requests that we did not support, and those were for Ride Finders and another agency called the Southeast Rural Community Assistance Project. And that's really all. So there is, like I said, someone here from Gutchel Cares, and then if I can answer any questions on the other agencies, I will do my best to answer those.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Sit tight. Board members? I think we're good. That was pretty straightforward. Thank you for that. Mr. Stamey? What do we got? General Services, Parks and Rec?
Absolutely. You're the operations, right? You're first.
Yes, operations is first. And here it is.
Do you want to wipe that off?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Derek Stamey, Deputy County Administrator for Operations. And before I get started, I wanted to take a couple of seconds of latitude, if you don't mind, as this is my my last budget presentation to you all and my last official board meeting. I know how much we all value community engagement. I know I do, and I know the board does. So I wanted to take this opportunity, because I've been waiting for the right time to do this, and to provide a gift to our probably our most engaged citizen. And I've got a gift here for Mr. Lyle, if he's still awake. It's a farming license plate with 3 minutes on the license plate. So with
you got a picture
with red hair like this, you can't hide anyway.
Awesome. Stay put. Good. We got the official. Stay put, Jonathan. Jonathan, come on.
I'm sorry.
We're calling you back to a mic.
Surprise.
Please exactly. Do not deduct this from my. Smile.
Yes,
sir, you got it. Now, every time you use your 3 minutes, you get to think of me. So
I'm just going to put it right here.
There you go.
That is nicely done.
You can add a red bulb to that, too, on the end.
I can't take 100% credit for that. The Commissioner of Revenue's office helped me with that item, so I've got to give them credit where credit is due. So with that, I have the pleasure of providing you with the fiscal year 22 budget proposed request to the board for our General Services Department, which includes our facilities management, grounds management, and convenience centers. Facilities management is responsible for the maintenance of all of our county-owned facilities, which is about 34 in total. We ensure that all of the facility-related needs of our residents, employees, tenants, and visitors are met, and part of that goal involves providing a clean and safe environment in all of our parks and general government facilities. Also, a very important function of our General Services Department is overseeing the implementation of the 25-year capital improvement plan. From a budgetary perspective, the facilities management budget did increase. The request for operating costs did increase by 12.4%. Keep in mind that it does include that 5.3 that we reduced back when COVID first entered our mindset. And that's primarily related to contractual services and a recalibration of our budget. We've added over 40% of our total square footage since 2017, about 61,500 square feet. And with that comes a tremendous amount of challenges, having the proper coverage from a staffing standpoint. This budget does include a full-time custodian. We did request a full-time maintenance technician, but it's not part of this proposed budget. And again, all of our increases are related to contractual services, utilities, maintenance, and custodial supplies. I touched on the 64,500 square foot increase. With that comes difficulties meeting our 3-hour max response time for high priority calls for service. COVID has also had a significant impact to general services. They've had to completely shift gears and renovate certain spaces so that we would create safety barriers. We've had to increase our sanitization efforts. We've had to flex staff. We have general services staff now flexing to assist with our vaccination efforts, as well as to handle COVID situations that may handle when staff, unfortunately, are hit with that illness, and we have to bring folks in and do extra cleanings and really be flexible in that regard. CIP impacts for fiscal year 22. Again, the department does manage all of the CIP projects for the county, with the exception of the utility projects. And the good news I have on the CIP front is that the Commissioner of Revenue will be moving into their new space next week. So that project is coming to a close. So that's another box that we can check. Now, from a project standpoint for the current calendar year and for the fiscal year, the Tucker Park Pedestrian Crossing project actually broke ground today. Met with a contractor on site this morning at 11 o'clock. I told him he needed to be done by March 31st. He said there's no way, but I will continue to push him as a private citizen. The Central High Field Relocation Project, the lighting is actually in fabrication right now. The fencing should be installed by the close of this week, and staff will begin actually building those fields within the next 2 weeks. That project should come to a completion sometime in mid-April, so we're going to continue to push that project to completion. All of these have been queued up and ready to go. County Gateway sign construction, we are still working with VDOT on the Gateway sign on Broad Street, and we have actively engaged our on-call contractors to begin the fabrication of some of our landmark and secondary signs. Our Human Resources and Community Development Office, work should have hit the street today to our on-call contractors, and we hope to initiate that work in the next 3 to 4 weeks. Future outlook and challenges for this department. Again, aging county infrastructure as well as adding new county infrastructure is always going to stretch your resources, and moving forward, that's going to continue to be a challenge. Also, meeting our desired response times related to maintenance requests will continue to be a challenge as well. Grounds management. Our grounds management functions within the General Services Department include the responsibility of maintaining all of our open spaces and parks. Again, that's approximately 32 locations. They manage the county's turf management program, all of our landscaping services, our irrigation, parking lot maintenance, and park services. Now, you're going to see a pretty good jump in our operating request for grounds management for this year. We did request an additional position in grounds and did not include that as the proposed budget. However, we did add some funds in our contractual services to help offset what we didn't feel like we could accomplish with staff. So in lieu of adding staff, we added contractual dollars to help maintain the level of service that our residents have been asking for. Just to give you an idea of all the different ground that we cover, the county has added additional space and landscaped areas that require additional resources. All these little green dots on the map represent areas that we do maintain, whether it's with our staff or with contracted services. And we'll continue to utilize that hybrid approach. Kind of the same story along with our facilities group. We've had additional facilities, and demand is ever increasing from our residents, and other county users and private entities are starting to request use of these facilities as well as they've come into the region and want to run tournaments. So that's going to be an ongoing challenge from a grounds perspective. Convenience centers, we do operate two convenience centers for use for citizens for safe and convenient disposal of household debris. That's the Central and Western Center. Operations do include the collection and coordination of both recyclables and the coordination of our countywide litter and recycling events. There is an increase in operating costs and personnel related to the convenience center budget. Right now, we are proposing an additional part-time position to assist with convenience center coverage. And we've also bumped our operating costs because what we have seen is a tremendous increase in the amount of debris and trash that is coming through our convenience centers. And as you haul out more material, your costs increase as well. So this past year, we saw an unbelievable increase when folks were stuck at home for weeks. They decided to clean out everything. But that's on top of what we were already seeing. So it's not a one-time anomaly. It's something that's been creeping up each year for the past 3 to 4 years. Some of our outlooks and challenges for the future, we are in the process of exploring an additional facility and location in the eastern portion of the county. It is in the capital improvement plan, and staff is very excited about potentially locking down a location for that. And I touched on it briefly earlier, but the continued increase in center use and visitation, it's just going to increase our annual costs associated with all of our contracted services. So with that, I'll take any questions on general services.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley. And by the way, I want to thank you all in general for on some of these sheets where you have the cross-reference to the budget page in our budget book. Those are very helpful. Thank you all for putting those in there. Ms. Lasklet.
Yeah, I really like that too. So thank you, Mr. Stamey. So yes, the part-time, the requested and proposed part-time additional person, does that change the hours?
It does not change the hours of the convenience center. What it does do, it allows for additional coverage. We don't have a deep bench. And in fact, we're down two staff right now, but it we need some flexibility to give us some breathing room as it pertains to scheduling folks. You know, especially when we start increasing the volume of these tire amnesty events and other cleanup events, we really need to have some folks on staff to be able to give us that flexibility.
All right. So that's not any increase in service. It's just the flexibility.
It's given us a bench. Gotcha. It's real okay. Thin right now.
Right,
yes,
thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah,
thank you, Ms. Lasklet. Any other? Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Doug, thank you for that presentation. Air filtration in the county facilities, I know we've had discussions with the schools to make sure that all the schools, the air filtration's been upgraded to address the current pandemic. Where does that stand on the county facilities?
Well, with us, you may recall we adopted a very robust HVAC replacement plan over the previous 5 years, and when we put in new HVAC components, we included that already in what we were doing. So okay. We reviewed the newest technology that was out there, and we didn't think it was as much of a benefit to the type of systems that we run and what we've already replaced. So we will build that into the CIP moving forward, that we'll continue to review that, but right now what we have in place is pretty much as good as you're going to get from a sanitization standpoint, right. Cleaning the
good.
Air.
Okay, I just want to make sure there's no legacy costs going forward to bring us up to speed, and it sounds like we're already there, so thank you.
Yes, sir.
That looks like all the questions. Thank you again for the
okay.
Presentation.
Okay.
It's taking too long to load up.
Gotcha. Okay, the next presentation I have for you today is the Parks and Recreation and Virginia Cooperative Extension proposed FY22 budgets. I'll start with Parks and Recreation. Primary functions of the department is to provide a variety of programs to our residents, our visitors, and to ensure that all of these activities are well balanced and that they're in a clean and safe environment. And we also another main function for Parks and Recreation is to serve as a conduit for all of our county-centric tourism and agritourism-related activities and programs and events. One of the goals that we've had was to work with our Economic Development Office and our Ag Center staff to really focus on serving as that conduit for our tourism initiative. Hope to keep that moving forward. The Parks and Recreation budget, at a quick glance, you will see a 10.3% increase in operating costs. Again, that 5.3 that was cut previously has been added back in, so it's really about a 5% increase over the previous year. And that's primarily related to contractual services and things of that nature. Some operating and COVID impacts as it relates to Parks and Rec. Parks and Rec is very busy, as you know. They've got ongoing support of large-scale community events, including an upcoming Boys State baseball tournament in July. We will be hosting the state tournament for the Dixie Youth League for the state of Virginia at Hidden Rock Park, and that's going to be a tremendous undertaking. We're going to host about 24 teams for that event. So it's going to be taxing, to say the least, and I'm sure they're thanking me for that. But they're also on the books to assist with the Riverfest event, as well as Rossawek, if and when those events come back online. Parks and Rec will still continue to work with our Agricultural Center staff on implementing the Agricultural Center plan and continue to develop the county's tourism initiative. COVID has had a significant impact on programming, as you may know. Parks and Recreation is really a face-to-face, interactive, social, unless it's a self-directed activity, it's a social experience. And I have to really commend Parks and Rec staff for how they have shifted from that face-to-face interaction to how they've creatively programmed for our residents, but also taken on new roles. You have folks that were programmers that are then all of a sudden, they're now working in a call center, or they're cleaning the buildings or sanitizing buildings. It's pretty amazing how staff has been so flexible and sought out ways to contribute when their role is completely changed. So I really got to tip my hat to them. It's really a testament to them and Ms. Kronberg's efforts. Future outlooks and challenges, recreation program and our facility-based services are continuing to increase. From a facility standpoint, we saw an increase of visitation in the past year of about 13%. That's without any athletics going on. So if in normal times we were seeing an average increase of about 4 to 5%, but to see a 13% increase, it's pretty amazing, especially when you consider the fields were empty. So they're getting used. They're popular. We're continuing to make improvements, and that's going to be an ongoing challenge. Also, continuing to implement the county-centric tourism initiative with economic development is going to be another challenge for Parks and Rec. Virginia Cooperative Extension. Their primary functions are to help the citizens of the county improve their lives through programming in agricultural and natural resources, family and consumer sciences, 4-H youth development, and community viability. They do develop educational programs based on a significant amount of research, and they develop that with input through local stakeholders and other interested parties within the community. They will continue to assist us, again, with the agritourism efforts. And they do provide support for other county agencies, such as the school system and Parks and Rec and community organizations as it relates to special events. Their budget includes a small increase related to personnel costs. And you may recall, I'm just going to jump ahead so that I can explain this, but we do contribute to two of the folks that work within the Extension office. We fully fund the horticultural assistant. But two of the positions, the 4-H agent and the unit coordinator, we do provide a third of their salary and fringe benefits, and that's what that contribution piece for the budget comes from. You can see it here. And that's embedded in the actual operating costs, whereas the personnel is related to the position that we fully fund. Future outlook and challenges for our Extension program. Again, its demand for programming and services is constantly increasing and had been increasing prior to COVID. And they are working primarily with adult-oriented services. One of the largest areas for growth that we're experiencing and getting requests for programming is ages 5 to 19. And again, COVID derailed the Ag Center plan. We had worked to develop that plan about a year ago, and we had just gotten some traction with trying to develop an Ag Board, and COVID kind of derailed that as we learned to operate in that environment. So picking that back up and running with that plan is going to be a challenge for both Parks and Rec and the Extension office moving forward. With that, I'll take any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Stamey and Mr. Sharp.
I know it's too early to fully know, but what are the plans, given what we do know? Is Parks and Rec working toward summer camps?
Yes, sir. That's a great question, and Ms. Kronberg is here, and she can answer it. If I'm not nailing it, you just let me know. But staff has done a really good job of when they've been given guidance from the governor's office, they take the paper, and not only do they read it, they call and ask for clarity. And they have worked steadfastly to create a program that meets all the requirements and the guidance that we've been given so that we can serve our residents, but then ease into a full-fledged program once we're allowed to and once we're able to. To answer your question, yes, they have developed, they've laid out a very nice, robust summer camp program for this year, and that information has been released. I know you've already seen a ton of registrations for that. There's a significant demand for it, and right now we're moving ahead, albeit it's a scaled-back program to meet those guidelines, but once we're able to step up those efforts, we'll be able to do that.
Great, because that's one of the hallmarks of the county, and one of the things that people enjoy most. And how are the mountain biking paths? How high is that now, mileage wise?
9.2
miles.
Yes, sir.
Great.
Yep, and we should be wrapping up all of the signage work in the mountain bike trails in the next, once it dries out, probably in the next month.
Have you been able to work out a way that the sheriff's office can look, or EMS can locate people if they call from the wooded areas? So that
we still need to meet with Eddie Ferguson and the sheriff to actually do a dry run of that to see how effective it is, because of all the different switchbacks and all the different pieces of the trail work. We want to actually try it on a dry run and see how effective and close it really is, and how closely it does triangulate your position. So it is on the radar.
Great.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Is that last piece you just talked about, does that have to happen before we get the night riding?
Yes. We would like to do that before we get the night riding. Yes, sir.
So how many days till you leave?
Well, I don't know. What day is it? The third? Second?
No,
so I've got a few, but yeah. I'll still be around. So.
No, I know. I heard from the mountain.
They've already texted me like three or four times.
They've been asking me what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Mr. Peterson.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thanks. This is a quick one. The tournament that's coming here could be a reasonably heavy lift. Is that designed to be break even? What's the economic impact of that tournament to the county?
I would have to do some research on that. What I can tell you is how we're approaching it from a county benefit standpoint. We're working with GYAA. We're working with our general services staff. That we're making sure that all the paperwork's covered from a public safety standpoint, special event permit standpoint. We've already reached out to the local hotel, the hotel in West Creek, to make sure that they're aware and that they're going to actively help us recruit folks to stay in Goochland and spend their money in Goochland when they actually hold the tournament. So we're actively coordinating to ensure that we're seeing a positive economic impact to the county.
Okay. So I know there's expense to run the lines down and, you know, mow the fields. I mean, I know there's a lot of county expense. I just didn't know if we're doing this out of the generosity.
Well, what we're doing is, we have typical standards in place for how we maintain the fields, but we also, a few years ago, we implemented a training program so that our staff who maintain the fields actually meet with the league, and they train them on how they would maintain the field, so that in the event that we're not able to, if a storm comes through, there's a whole crew of parents that have signed liability waivers so that they can work on county property and have been trained and essentially certified on how to maintain a field. We provide them the materials, they split the cost with us, and then they step in and help run the tournament. That's pretty much what we're talking about here. Is a true partnership and collaboration.
Okay. And there's entry fees and things that would, I mean, you know how we're doing this, the programs out at Central High, we're trying to at least break even on this stuff so it's not just a drain on resources that.
Sure. And GYAA will use this as a fundraiser for their organization, and they have, in the past year alone, they've given back in terms of facility improvements probably about $85,000 into Hidden Rock Park. So this is another opportunity for them to raise money and put it back into the park system and help improve it.
Okay. All right. So. Thank you.
Ms. Lesway.
Okay. So there are significant increases in the parks and rec budgets, and I know you get a lot of the revenue from the fees or the, you know, charges, and it sounded like most of these increases are contract costs.
Mm-hmm.
That just get passed to us, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So are we raising all the fees?
No, we are not. And let me address that a different. Let me answer your question. I know where you're getting at. So we our instructor payment process. We only pay an instructor. It's an 80-20 split. So if I sign up for a program, it's $100. The instructor gets 80 from us. We keep 20 for our administrative costs and coverage. That's it. So we have a bucket of contracted services. Now, what I've asked Ms. Kronberg to do is to ensure that as she works through her budget, that if we're not, we have to be careful that we're not spending the contracted services without bringing in revenues. So there's a balance there. We may not even spend that money, if that makes sense, if you don't bring in the actual programmatic revenue.
So we're just going to get further and further behind then every year as this gets, the contract costs are probably going to just go up.
Yeah, we don't pay them unless somebody pays us. So the contracted costs I'm talking about are like maintenance costs related to like, and you can step in at any time with your contracted costs, but there are certain costs that we're incurring facility-wise.
Operational cost.
What's that?
Operational costs.
Yes.
Then that's the other reason why we should raise the fees.
The biggest increase that we see year to year is actually Sheriff's Office with the fireworks show. That cost goes up every year. So we don't charge people to come see the fireworks. So that's a cost that, if that makes sense.
Well, it should be built in then across the board and averaged out.
So to back to what Mr. Samey was saying, as far as our fees that we pass along to people, those are set by our instructors. We negotiate the fees with them to what we know our residents will pay for a program. And then we pass along the 80% gets paid to the instructor. The 20% is kept for Parks and Rec for, like, administrative costs.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
Sort of. Not really.
So what shows up in the budget? Is the 100 or just the 20 that we retain? Or what?
In the instructor payments line, that's the 80% that they get paid. The revenue is the 100% that they pay. So part of our increases this year in our budget are going to technology increases, contractual increases, like for our refs for basketball, and those prices are reflected. So the refs that we're paying for basketball, the contract, the price for that increases every year as well. That's passed along in the program fee for the registrant.
So you are raising some fees.
Not across the board, but to cover costs. If the contract is directly related to the program, the fee covers that cost.
But we'll never recoup the cost, the operating costs that go up year after year after year. We never get that back. I mean, so this is really not a program that pays for itself.
The entire
of the
department.
Fees.
Portions of it do.
Portions of it do. Our
things
programs
like,
pay for
what
themselves.
What percentage?
Our cost recovery, I can get back to you on that, but our cost recovery over the years has been program specific. We try to keep it around 80%.
And that's higher than most of
higher
our neighboring localities.
What does the 80% represent?
It's our cost recovery for just the programmatic piece.
Gotcha. That's the 80-20 you were talking about.
That's different. That's the payout for the instructor.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, gotcha.
Yep.
Gotcha.
So there are certain elements like July 4th, we don't charge anything, so it's 0%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fall Festival, we don't charge anything, 0%. Same with the tree lighting. So when we talk about program-specific items that we run as a department, we shoot for that 80% cost recovery piece.
Right. Okay.
80% of all your department costs?
No, just the programs.
Okay.
Your variable costs.
Because they do some programs in-house.
Not all the other stuff we do.
You're seeking to recover 80% across all the programs?
Yes.
But not everything they do?
Correct.
Correct.
Everything
correct.
They do is not programs.
Right.
Okay. Correct. Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. I really appreciate it. So one last question. I'm just curious. You're talking about support of large-scale events. We talked about the Boys State baseball tournament, and you've got Riverfest and Rasselwick. I thought Riverfest and Rasselwick were both private events,
so
county. So what do we support?
So with Riverfest, that's actually run by the Friends of Goochland Parks, and they do those events to actually help raise money to put back in the park system.
Right.
So we assist them with marketing. We don't provide any funding to the Friends to operate
okay.
it.
Okay,
we assist with
sense.
The permitting, kind of the same thing with Rossawick. We want to be a good neighbor and help them achieve their goals. So we'll help them with marketing. We may staff some folks that day. It's typically full-time staff that can flex their schedules. But, you know, we want to be there as a department representative. They're helping raise money to go back into our park system. So we see that as a benefit to have a couple of staff on site.
Okay. Thank you.
So you're providing in kind but not hard dollar support?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Sharp.
And we're going to have a disc golf course set up within a couple of months.
It's my understanding. The trail's been completed. So.
Is that a challenge? Okay, all right, I'll be there. Tell me when and where. Yep, thank you.
All right.
Looks like I'll, thank you again, Mr. Stamey.
Thank you much.
Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
So it looks to me, if I'm keeping track, we've covered item 3 on the new business. We're up to number 4, the last item. And so, Mr. Jarmite, you're between us and supper.
So is this not when I said we're going to go through every single bill in the General Assembly? Yeah. We're going to break it down by committee. Good afternoon. I believe it's still afternoon. Paul Drumright, Administrative Services Manager. And I'm going to take 3 minutes to go through the General Assembly legislative update. The first thing I got to say is they've gone home for now. So I think that's great news. They ended session yesterday, so they have gone home. So we're going to cover real quick just the General Assembly session, so our priority request, and then a couple bills of interest. As you can see, so we have the time frame. Again, they adjourned yesterday, March 1st. They'll be back April 7th. They started way back in January 13th and went through and then wound up going into a special session because the governor called them into that special session. You can see up on, we also have a tracking of how many bills were there. There were, so far, 934 bills have been passed by them. And out of all that time that they're there. And so that's a lot of legislation. And mind you, it is through COVID time, so it's not the usual process. Moving forward, we're going to hit, the priority requests that are up on your screen. These were as part of the board's legislative agenda that was adopted in December. And prior to that, we discussed these through the meeting with our legislative delegation. So the first one is expand broadband. Again, that is a very important topic for the county, and it's been one of our focuses on our legislative agenda for a number of years. I'm pleased to say that the governor's budget and the budget that has been approved by the General Assembly has increased the amount of money for fiscal year 2022 for up to $50 million. It was at about $39 million, so they've added additional funding for the state grant program. We've actually are waiting to hear on 2 state grants we filed through that program this year. And so we're still waiting, hoping to hear some positive news, but it's great that they're continuing to invest more money into that. Moving on, there were a number of different bills related to broadband. I have them up on your screen. The first one relates to expanding an existing pilot project that relates to utilities being able to extend fiber, middle-mile fiber, along their networks. That's allowing municipal broadband authorities to participate in that. They passed that bill. Another one, broadband service territory maps, that was requiring the state to create a broadband map. That got killed, but as part of the budget, they are funding a state broadband map. And this is good news because the maps from the federal government are not correct. As many people know, you can't rely on them. So it's great news that they are the state's going about another way to handle that issue. And so that exciting news coming on that. HB 2304, this is also a very exciting bill. As you may recall, again, there's the utility middle mile fiber bill, Dominion, who's been doing some pilot projects around middle mile fiber. This is making that permanent. So no longer is it a pilot project, it is a permanent project, and it allows Dominion now what they have to do, so they can, they have to go and file with the State Corporation Commission, because they can recap some of those costs they're expending to build fiber to help expand broadband, but they have to go through the State Corporation Commission to do that. And so that outlines that whole process. This is going to be important as we look to expand broadband, as we work with providers in the county. So this is great news to see this moving forward. And then the final one down there, SB 1225, Boisco. This gives the authority of school boards to be able to use funds to help expand broadband when it comes to education purposes. So this could be another tool in the toolbox as we continue to work on our broadband efforts. So for broadband, it's a great session. Moving on, I have this slide is not correct. As you heard earlier from Mr. Lynn, that the budget actually did include funding for the general registrar compensation, and actually they're pegging that to that of the treasurer. So pay no attention to this. Great news on that front.
How did that happen? Did you just anticipate? Did you anticipate it?
Yeah. When you read the budget book, you miss one page. We had in there about the Watch for Children signs program, trying to change that up with VDOT. There was no corresponding legislation submitted to this at all. Our fourth priority related to getting another tool in the toolbox related to prohibiting or regulating tannerite. No corresponding legislation related to that either. Moving on to some bills of interest, we were tracking Children's Services Act. There were some bills related to special education in the Children's Services Act. We have all of them up there on the screen. Really, the one that matters is HB 2117 and SB 1313. That passed. The two at the bottom got rolled into that bill. And so that does a couple things. One, it will allow special private day special education students to be transitioned back to the school system. And two, it takes the money from the Children's Services Act for funding those students and puts it into the Department of Education's budget. So it does not impact the CSA program in the future. It won't impact that program. So it will put it back towards the schools, the rightful owner of that. So that's good news from CSA. So, and then the HB 2212, that just tells the Office of Children's Services, outline some of their responsibilities. So overall, not too bad in this section either. Moving on to two other bills that we were tracking. The first one up there has a long title, otherwise known as the Qualified Immunity Bill, HB 2045. That bill was left in committee. And then the SB 1469 was the Opioid Abatement Authority bill, which was to deal with when there's a settlement between the state and opioid manufacturers. And that actually has been passed by both houses. So that's good news on that. That's moving forward. And with that, I might have been over a little bit, 3 minutes, but I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you for good, concise, and informative. Mr. Spoonow.
As with a lot of things in this new role that I had for 13 months now, this has been the most interesting to see how this correlates to the Schoolhouse Rock of getting a bill through. So just to kind of summarize, so we met back with our legislators, and of the requests that we made, only half of them were carried through. Is that right? So although I didn't see anything from any of our legislators on priority 1, 3, or 4,
that'd be accurate. So they may not have carried a bill, But they voted for the if they voted for the budget, voted to put the money in there to expand the Virginia Telecommunications Initiative, that's supporting that program.
How
so,
about, but for 3 and 4.
So for 3 and 4, they we did not have any corresponding legislation. They did not file one for us on those requests.
Okay.
Those both of those came later in the session, and. What we can do is, if this is a priority of those still to work on, work with our delegation over the over the spring summer, and get it positioned for next year. And that routinely happens with bills. The first time out, you do not always get knocked out of the park. You may get a bill, it may get killed in the committee. You have to come back and work on it, and bring it back.
Thank you.
I think to your point, if we can get started a little bit earlier, and I've said it for a while, when we have something that's specific like Watch for Children signs, I almost think we should almost work towards like drafting something and hand them something like, will you carry this? And then hope that they'll, with their other jurisdictions that they serve and the limited number that they can put in, we'll try to squeeze one in. Because how many could they introduce a delegate?
They initially had a very compressed time frame for the session, so they limited the number of bills that they were going to carry.
15, and I hope they didn't reduce it from 15. But
the governor again acted to bring them into special because they had a number of weighty matters that they were dealing with. So he called a special session to bring it to their normal, what it would have been their normal session time.
Right.
And so they continued a lot of their bills, but so hopefully. We'll be back into a little bit more of a normal operating procedure when they come back into next time they come back into session.
Yeah, it's already March, so let's think about September. We'll be here before we know it. And traditionally, we've met with them in September. I don't think we should meet with them any later than that if we can.
We've tried between the summer and the fall to work with them. We had a couple issues this year amidst that the governor's restrictions, COVID,
absolutely.
Everything that prevented us.
No doubt. Mr. Sharp, did you have anything?
I just had a question. SB 1225 under broadband. Broadband services, school boards to appropriate funds for expansion of services for education.
Yes, sir. So that bill allows them for students who get, I believe it's free or reduced lunch or qualify in certain categories, that school boards in the school system can expend money to help fund broadband on that. So it becomes another tool in that toolbox that they were trying to put forward, giving authority to help with that, to work with providers in that aspect. And I will say already our school system is a partner with us on our different broadband initiatives. And so as we look at all the bills that come out of the session and if there's no changes to them after the governor gets them and signs them, look and see, does that make sense to use that? Are there other vehicles like the utility bills working with our public and private utilities to expand broadband? So another tool for the toolbox.
Okay.
I think his concern is probably this would be really changing the structure of government if school boards can now appropriate money. Because I think, I'm looking at the bill, but...
Yeah, where do they appropriate that money from? If it's from the General Assembly, that's wonderful.
Again...
If it's from us...
That becomes a policy decision of the Board of Supervisors working with the school board about funding issues and whether to appropriate funding in that mechanism or use some of the other mechanisms that we have, that we've used in the past to... focus on broadband expansion.
Yeah,
the bill is, yeah, we don't want to, but that's one I think we'll look at. How is it going to impact us and the relationship between us and the school board? Real quickly, it says any locality or the public body of the Commonwealth may appropriate public funds, personal property, real estate, or donations to any local school board, school division, public school, charitable institution. And so, the question I think we're having is, where is this money that they're appropriating coming from?
Yeah.
So we'll continue to.
Exactly. So again, just another tool, not necessarily something to actually use, but it's there to look at and to evaluate whether that's the appropriate one, whether going through the Economic Development Authority is an appropriate matter, or again, using some of the other mechanisms that are out there.
You're spot on. I mean, you've heard us say, let's put all the options on the table, and so thank you for
that. That's what we tell our providers every time we talk with them.
All right, we're.
Thank you very much.
I think, are we good to take a dinner break?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Jarmite.